righty, Rick Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is part of what we're going to be talking about.
Breaking news. The FBI is now investigating a shooting in West Palm Beach as an attempted assassination against former President Donald Trump.
There you go. It's weird because, you know, on Sunday, Americans go to church. Many of them then sit around and watch football all day. They generally don't watch the news or care about the news. And then that happened. What seems like a thwarted assassination attempt. Again, I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. All right, so we're going to do this story. Everyone seems to be talking about it. It's what authorities are saying at this point that we have for you. Apparently, a Secret Service agent who accompanies the former president when he plays golf spotted something weird. He saw like what looked like a stick or something sticking out of a fence that borders the area where Mr. Trump plays golf in Palm Beach, Florida. When the agent went over there to take a look, they found an AK-style rifle with a scope and a GoPro camera right there in that lair, that site, right? The suspect obviously saw the agents coming toward him, so he took off. He was eventually caught, by the way, so we know who he is now. Let me show him to you. That is Ryan Routh. He was arraigned in a federal court Monday morning on several charges, including gun possession. Why did he want to shoot the former president while playing golf? Well, by all accounts, it's because he's obsessed with Russia. Seems to hate the place, hates the country, hates the president, has expressed a desire to blow up the Capitol. His obsession has even led him to Kyiv, where apparently he tried to join the military there to fight against Russia, also recruit others to do so. He's very much out there when it comes to social media platforms, using those social media platforms, as best I can tell, to attack anybody who has a contrasting opinion than his. Let me give you an example. Here he is going after Tulsi Gabbard, where he writes, "You are an idiot. Why don't you go and join Putin and Trump and be their third leg? Please leave Hawaii. You embarrass me. Shut your stupid mouth," he writes. And then he goes on to say that he's going to go and fight and die for Ukraine. So, I mean, there you have it. Take it as you will. Routh is, to say the very least, a bit of a strange bird who seems very angry and very obsessive. He also seems to display a decades-long criminal history for all kinds of things like serious gun violations, resisting arrest, and other run-ins with police over the past 10 or 15 years. Yet here's what's kind of weird, I think, anyway. Despite all of that, the New York Times has written about this guy. And when they wrote about him, this is a long time ago, 2023. They don't mention any of these things that I just mentioned to you, any of these details about his character. This article about Americans who have bought into the anti-Russia hype and are now volunteering to go to Ukraine and fight on behalf of Ukraine and recruit others to fight for Ukraine. That's what the article was about. So let me read from this article to you now. Ready? The article highlights Routh's efforts. In fact, here, this is what it says. Ryan Routh, a former construction worker from Greensboro, North Carolina, is seeking recruits from among Afghan soldiers who fled the Taliban. Mr. Routh, who spent several months in Ukraine last year, said he helped plan to move them, in some cases illegally, from Pakistan to Iran and then to Ukraine. Now, as I'm reading this to you, I'm just thinking to myself, and I can't help but wonder if that little mini profile by the Times didn't like maybe even harden Routh even more, you know, perhaps making him feel like, you know, maybe he'd finally found his true calling, right? After all, I mean, it's not every day the New York Times calls you and says, we want to write a story about you, right? And here they are profiling him. Well, that's not fair. It wasn't a profile of him. It was a profile of other people who were doing what he was doing, but he was among those, to be fair and accurate. It also makes one wonder, given his public profile, what our government did or did not know about him. This is another interesting point. This is Edward Snowden wondering about the very same thing on Twitter, right? He writes, again, this is Edward Snowden, not me. He writes, with the alleged Trump shooter's personal and public participation in military activity in Ukraine, it's hard to imagine how the White House's agencies can claim zero contact. You know, and then he writes parenthetically, clean hands. Something of an Oswald vibe here. Congress should get answers. All right. If you think that sounds a little overly conspiratorial, so do I. I think it is overly conspiratorial at this point. But you do wonder, how did this guy become so obsessed with hating Russia that it took over his whole persona and then did this thing? I mean, if he did it, it's alleged. Look, I think it has to do with messaging, the kind of messaging that we get in this country from the media. The media, who, by the way, takes orders from certain people in our government, who make monsters out of our adversaries for war and profit, I think. And this guy went in deep. I mean, he went in real deep. Manila, what saith you? And welcome back.
Thank you. Very happy to be back, Rick. And boy, what a week to come back to. First, I mean, addressing this whole issue of conspiracy, I think if we hearken back to just, a year or two ago during the whole COVID era, I think the difference between conspiracy theorists and factual journalists or what have you is, I don't know, give it six months. I think we're going to uncover a lot more facts about Mr. Routh. From what we know, the scant information we have is a lot of screeds, rambling screeds all over social media. And like you said, I agree with you. He seems to have been deluded into this whole good versus bad, Ukraine good, Russia evil, you know, Zelensky good, Vladimir Putin, demon from hell.
Yeah.
This is all, as you pointed out, and I think rightfully so, is through so much intense media just completely highlighting pro-Ukraine, never ever hearing the other side of this war. I mean, look, I'm myself personally, you know, against any wars, but that's just not the world that we live in. And things don't happen in a vacuum. And Mr. Routh has had his, you know, 15 minutes of fame right before this would-be attempted assassination, where he actually spoke to, I guess, local press in Ukraine, and Newsweek actually got a hold of that video, and he explains what he's doing there in Ukraine, and he paints this caricature of how he views this world and foreign policy and the role of the United States as being this, you know, 100% always right in the good, and Ukraine is in that fold, and Russia is evil. But we hear this 24/7 from the media, Rick, for 2.5 straight years.
That's the point. In other words, our enemies are all monsters, and our allies are all the most perfect people in the world. And, you know, as you just said, usually things don't work out that way. The monsters aren't really that bad of monsters, and the good guys aren't always all that good. Unfortunately, in our media, that doesn't exist anymore. Like we've said, you know, even during the Vietnam War, there were those who were pesky enough to ask questions, and then eventually the American people started asking the kind of questions that helped to end that war. Where are those reporters? Where are those people today? And you're right. That's part of what the problem is right now. But it's not just with I don't think it's just with the left. Because look, here's what I think, and I want to ask you about this as well. If the media on the left has Americans chasing ghosts on foreign affairs front, I would argue the media on the right does the same thing on domestic issues, wedge issues. Like, there's no better example of this, obviously, than what's happening this weekend in Springfield, Ohio. The FBI is now officially investigating death threats against members of the Haitian American community. That this is causing schools to shut down, outdoor activities to be canceled. Here, take a listen.
Wittenberg University in Springfield canceling all in-person activities on campus after administrators said they received an email threatening a potential shooting on campus, specifically targeting members of the Haitian community. And in the safety alert that went out overnight to students and staff, administrators referencing that local uptick in threats against area schools, government buildings, and hospitals. All of this since Tuesday's debate, when former President Trump on stage repeated that viral and local officials stress baseless claim that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio are stealing and eating people's pets.
Now, here's what I see. This Haitian phobia created by media mostly on the right, just like the Russia phobia created by media mostly on the left, it's a horrible trend and a byproduct of the deterioration of our media in general. Americans have stopped believing in what used to be subjective journalism, so they now seek alternatives that tell them only what the hell they want to hear. And the government and both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, validate it. They like it. They like when the media does this. I mean, you want to develop an obsessive hatred of Russia? Just watch MSNBC all day. I guarantee you, you'll come out hating Russia. You want to develop an obsessive hatred of immigrants in general, whether they're Haitian or not? Watch Newsmax all day. I guarantee you, you'll come out with a hatred obsession of all immigrants in general, be they legal or illegal, by the way. Go ahead, Manila. I want to bring you back in. I bet you want to weigh in on this because, you know, I'm an immigrant. This means a lot to me, and I know it does to you, too.
Yeah, I am the child of immigrants. And again, I'm going to harken back to just 2 years ago during the whole COVID era where we saw, again, inflammatory rhetoric coming from President Trump. I guess at that point, that was 4 years ago when he was still the president. Mm-hmm. And the inflammatory words that he chose that kind of snowballed into what became Asian hate and the whole Chinese wet markets and the Asians eat weird things. They're eating bats. They're eating this and that and the other thing. Because it, like you said, creates this xenophobic environment. And the media, depending on which, you know, side of the aisle you fall on, what you choose to watch, is gonna support you and keep you in that silo of hate for this thing or the other thing. It's a lot of media hyperbole, and there seems to be no fairness when it comes to, you know, this topic or that topic. And to your point, the fact that people have social media to amplify not only what they watch on TV, but now they have social media to amplify and further dig into whatever it is that they believe, whether it's, you know, Haitians eating cats or, you know, COVID started at a Chinese wet market with the Chinese folks eating bats. It certainly creates an environment for hate that should be stamped out at this point, because the whole point of social media was to connect people and to make us get to know one another and learn one another. Instead, it has further siloed people into whatever it is that they believe. And with these, the Haitians there, specifically in Springfield, Ohio, I think in all fairness to the people there, it's a town of about 60,000 people. And when you bring in an influx of 20,000 other people, you're talking, you know, a new one-third of the population who are brand new. And I think any reasonable person could understand why anybody
frustrations, of course.
Any background, right, would be frustrated and kind of put off by this whole brand new influx of people that need, you know, aid, that are going to put strain on resources.
Yeah. And
that's the eating pets thing. There are real reasons to be upset that there are migration problems.
Yeah, and that's part of the history of the world, part of the history of the United States. There have always been other communities who've come in and made the communities that were there feel threatened by it, and that's something that requires context and real conversation, and you need a media that is able to come in. And just like we could look at the whole Russia-Ukraine situation, and there's plenty to blame with Russia, and say, I wish there's some things that they had done differently, but you don't solve the problem by name-calling, and you don't solve the problem by accusing people of eating other people's pets. So, but that's what the media does, unfortunately. That's where they live. That's what seems to help them prosper. And that, by the way, on the immigration front especially, is what we're going to be talking about in just a little bit with our next guest. But excellent conversation. Welcome back, Manila. Missed you.
Thank you. So happy to be back, Rick.
We'll see you again tomorrow. All right. So when we come back, we're going to be joined by the person who's written one of the best books on this very subject. Aviva Chomsky is a professor at Salem State University in Massachusetts. She's going to join us next to talk about how and why immigration has become such a hostile topic in America. How did we get here, right? We'll be right back. You stay right there. So let me tell you about our next guest. Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. Dr. Aviva Chomsky wrote Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. And recently she also released Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Migrants, and the Roots of Migration. The good professor is good enough to join us now. I guess we start with where we are in the United States as far as news goes. What do you make of this new immigration controversy that this time happens to be about, but I feel weird even saying this, Haitians eating other people's pets. But I say that knowing that it sounds ridiculous just to phrase it that way or frame it that way, because I think there's so much more to this story, right?
Definitely. And, you know, I was just listening with interest to what you were talking about before, about the silos in the media and, you know, the right wing and the left wing media. But I would actually say that, well, you know, I'm not even sure we really have a left wing media in the United States, at least not one that's very widely available. Mm-hmm. That there's, while there is a difference between, you know, the sort of Trump narrative, and then I could say the Biden-Harris New York Times narrative. In that the Biden-Harris New York Times narrative, which I would call pretty much a center or mainstream rather than a leftist narrative.
Right.
Will reject some of the inflammatory language used by the Trump narrative and the right-wing media and say, oh, it's terrible, it's racist, we don't want to say things like this, that's not who we are, they always say. But I actually think that they share a good deal of the narrative by, I mean, first of all, if you look at the Biden administration's policies, the Obama administration's policies, the Biden administration's policies, as compared to the Trump administration policies, you see a lot of criminalization of immigrants and really draconian anti-immigrant policies being enforced at the border. You see all of them promoting this narrative that there's a crisis at the border. And I mean, you see the New York Times promoting this too. And you really see the mainstream media failing to challenge the underlying narrative. Even that immigrants are a threat and the border is a security threat, even while they try to take a more, a softer line and say, oh, but we're not racist like Trump. And
No.
Look, I have not seen any analysis on the part of the New York Times or other mainstream media or the Biden administration, the Harris campaign, as to what has the United States' role been in Haiti in promoting the crises that are pushing people out of Haiti.
And by the way, we should probably take a step back and ask a question here, to be fair. And you're right, by the way, we use labels all the time, and sometimes they're not correct. Labels are always something you use as a guide, but don't take them too seriously. I think you're right to characterize it as the pro-Trump movement in America and the Democratic movement in America is a better description right now for what's going on than left and right. You're also right to say that it looks to me like Kamala Harris is actually co-opting most of Mr. Trump's immigration policies. But now let's talk about what people are talking about in the country. And Manila raised this point. What do you say to those people in this moment who live in Springfield, Ohio, and they feel besieged by all of these people who are so different, don't necessarily speak their language, because as we know, most Haitians speak French or Patois or whatever, Creole, whatever you want to call it, don't look like them, and they already feel like as Americans, things are being taken away from them, and now they see these 20,000 people come in, and they don't feel good about that. Do they have a right to not feel good about that? Should we not tell their stories too?
Well, of course, the media should be telling everybody's stories. However, I have not seen, and I mean, the media has quoted city officials from Springfield, residents of Springfield, non-immigrant residents of Springfield. I have not seen the vitriol coming from people in Springfield. On the contrary, I have seen people in Springfield saying, yes, there are pressures on services and we have to figure out how to adjust in the schools, but I have not seen that kind of vitriol coming from people in anybody who I've seen interviewed in Springfield. Now, that's not to say that one couldn't go to Springfield and find somebody who's going
to make
really racist anti-immigrant statements. But I mean, surveys that have been done in the United States have actually shown that there's more anti-immigrant sentiment in places that have not experienced immigration than there is in regions that have experienced immigration. Because in regions where there are significant numbers of immigrants,
they get along.
People understand the the multiple layers of how immigration affects a community, whereas it's the people in communities that have not experienced immigration that are more likely to latch on to these narratives that, well, immigrants are the fault, you know,
yeah,
to blame for everything that's wrong. And there are, like, not only in communities where there are large numbers of immigrants, there are a lot of structural economic problems, housing issues, pressures on services in areas that have not experienced immigration as well.
Yeah, I was once sent to do a series of reports all over the country on communities affected this way, and I found one in North Georgia. It's called Dalton, Georgia. That used to be the market mill, the place where they make carpeting, exactly, the carpet capital of the world. But then all the people who used to work there, who were just regular, you know, old people who had come back from the World War II, had either died off, and their children didn't want their jobs, so they literally recruited and got tons of Latin Americans to go in there. So I went there and I asked the Chamber of Commerce, and I asked the pastors, and I asked the people who had all the small businesses, and they said, we love these guys. They're always here on time. They never commit crimes. They're great workers. And I was like, this is not the story I thought I was going to be writing. So you're absolutely right.
Springfield was a community in decline that was losing population. It was a dying community where industries had closed. And everything that I have read coming out of Springfield has talked about, and this is not only Springfield, but very common in other rural declining communities around the United States. And not only rural, but also urban declining communities, that it's the immigrant population that is revitalizing places that are losing population and losing capacity to survive as communities.
Statistics I have seen says they're more apt to create new jobs. Because they start new businesses because they come here, they get together with families. They're more apt to work more hours than the average American. They're less apt to commit crimes than the average American. So the statistics are solid, but I still understand why someone feels bad about losing their community, and some of that is just emotional, and we have a right to have a discussion about it. We don't have a right to accuse people of eating other people's pets. But here's the point that I love talking to you about, and here's the thing that most of my fellow Americans and your fellow Americans don't understand. Those people who come to America, they don't want to be here. I mean, yeah, they want to be here now because it's a great place to live and you can do, but their goal in life was not to wake up one day in Honduras or Venezuela or Cuba or anywhere and say, I'm going to leave here and go work and go be somewhere else. The conditions cast upon them that caused them to make that decision were often caused by something, an external force that happened in their country, wars, drug stuff. And more often than not, I hate to say it, we caused it. Yes, us, good old USA. We go into these countries, we create conditions that make the people want to leave. Then we get mad that they're here. Am I wrong?
Really? You know, if you look statistically, the greater the US intervention is in a country, the more immigrants come to the United States. And that goes for basically the entire world. Everywhere we intervene, and everywhere our companies are pushing people off the land, and everywhere we sign free trade agreements, we start seeing waves of migration.
Why doesn't anybody talk about it? You don't hear that on CNN. You don't hear that on Fox. You don't hear that in the New York Times. It takes Chomsky and Sanchez to be having this discussion here on a channel that's not even allowed to be seen in the United States. It kind of sucks.
But that's what I mean, that... we're not allowed to be seen in the United States?
No, apparently not. But you're being seen by tens of millions of people everywhere else. And of course, they are watching us in the United States, but not on, like, cable television, I should say.
Not on TV.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what I mean by that the mainstream media reinforces the far-right narratives by neglecting or refusing or willfully... deciding not to address those questions.
Huh. Well, and why do they do that?
Why do they do that?
Why will Rachel Maddow complain about Putin and Russia, but she won't tell you about what we just did in Venezuela? Why is one interference, but the other one is unmentionable?
Well, I would say a couple of different reasons. One is that the media is... a commercial operation, right? It's a money-making operation.
Yeah.
And so it's dependent on advertising, and it's dependent on ratings, and that pushes the media into both prioritizing ratings and prioritizing not alienating its sponsors. Another piece is that the media is, it's not easy to break into the media world.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I talking to you instead of the New York Times?
Right.
So that the people who rise in the media world are people who buy into and accept the dominant narratives, and anybody who challenge, you know, and I see that in universities too, that if you start questioning too many things and causing too much trouble, people are going to say, well, that person's hard to get along with, or that person, you know, doesn't really fit our culture.
That's how.
So people are educated into a system, and those who accept the norms of the system are those who are going to rise in the system.
You know, they say a good conversation should be one where two people are kind of thinking about what the next question is and figuring out what the topic is as they get into it. And I felt like you and I have done that during this conversation. I was like thinking through what you were saying, and you were responding to some of the comments that I made. So for me, it's been a real delight. I hope people all over the world who watch this conversation enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you so much, Professor, for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, likewise. And that's our show. Remember, like we always like to say around here, truths, they don't live in boxes, right? So always look outside your own box when you're looking for truths. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.